Okay.
Yes, we're ready to go. We're ready to go.
Please forgive me again. Your name is Mr. Edward King, correct?
Right.
You're from Montreal?
Right.
Montreal, in Canada, of course. And you teach religion?
Okay.
And you're sort of, shall we put it this way, a Christopher Dawson buff or advocate, correct?
Right.
And the reason you're in New York is because you're involved in some kind of scholarly endeavor trying to revive an interest in Christopher Dawson.
Partly, and to meet with the man from Homeland who is connected with the republishing of all his work.
Okay. And the point is, last night at the Mid-Hudson Catholic Forum, you gave an informal talk, which was, I think, pretty informative about some of Mr. Dawson's views and his what you feel are some of the defects of current, shall we say, Catholic education or Catholic approaches on things.
Right.
And I found that interesting, but I didn't think it was appropriate to, shall we say, attack you last night. So I asked for some time this morning, and that's why we're here now. Okay?
Right.
And briefly, if I remember correctly, one of your main points was as follows. Correct me if I'm wrong, and to just elaborate on a little bit, and let me attack it. You were holding that when we teach Western history in
right.
this country and in Canada, in this part of the world, or even in the Western world these days,
right.
we do it without reference to religion, and therefore we're studying what you would hold, and Mr. Dawson would hold, a Christian-engendered culture and civilization without reference to Christianity.
Right.
And yet, by the same token, everybody who studies the history of the Middle East, or say the problem in Israel, would of course study Jewish history and Islamic influences, and anybody who studies Southeast Asia would study about Buddhism, and India about Hinduism. But you say it seems improper, or incongruous at least, that we are now doing the opposite when it comes to Western culture, because
right.
we leave out the Christian aspect, which essentially is basic Catholicism,
right.
and this sort of makes us sort of intellectual orphans. Is that correct?
Right. It warps our our sense of the past, our view of history.
Right.
our sense of the past, our view of history. See, Dawson's his first book that he wrote had nothing to do with Christianity. It was a study of the origins of culture in Asia and in Europe. And it goes way back, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, to the Ice Ages. And that's where he picked up his concept of culture, you know, from the anthropologists and the archaeologists and that group of scholars. So that when he got around to writing The Making of Europe, which is around 1932, his ideas of culture and culture formation and culture contact had already been had been formed by these earlier studies of prehistoric Europe and Asia. And when he came to study the formation of, well, first he called it Christendom, because Europe in those days was not an intelligible term. You know, Europe is a term that came into being, I think, after the Renaissance. So he says, if you look at the evidence impartially, I mean, what do you have? You have the civilization of Rome, let's say 400 AD, and you have a series of barbarian cultures, that he calls them. These are warrior aristocracies who dominate peasant societies all across Europe, various configurations of that pattern. Now, he said if Christianity had not brought some kind of sociological unity into this mass of Islam probably would have done the job, because they were the nearest rival to Christianity. But he says, if you look at Europe from the geographical point of view, all it is it's an extension of the whole landmass from Asia. And the fact that 1,000 years later there were a group of states that had some common cultural consciousness has to be explained. And the explanation to him when he looked at the evidence was that the church is the force that united the various barbarian groups into some kind of unity. And I find it hard to dispute that. You know, if I look at the evidence that he looked at, I really can't see that you can criticize that and say it's not true. You know, how do you explain? It is true that in 400 A.D., you know, you had Rome and you had all these various, let's call them barbarian cultures, you know. And how come all these barbarian cultures, 1,000 years later, had this common consciousness, you know, of a European culture or even a Christianity that was divided by that time, but was nevertheless a cultural unity?
Okay, allow me to jump in there first.
All right.
If I may. It appears to me that if that were true, then there would have been a unity in Europe before the rise of Charlemagne. But yet we really don't see any unity in Europe up until that time. What I'm seeing is a whole bunch of massive movements.
Yeah.
I see a whole bunch of Goths fighting Visigoths, fighting Ostrogoths, fighting Vandals, fighting Burgundians, and invasions of the Mongols and the Huns and everybody else.
Right.
And what we have instead is Charlemagne being crowned Holy Roman Emperor,
then
going out and doing some very anti-Catholic stuff, such as forcible conversions to essentially suppress the Saxons and the pagans in Germany.
Right.
Now, that is definitely anti-Catholic. We don't believe in forcible conversions, but he felt, of course, that by using a veneer of Christianity on these people, they would ultimately be suppressed and maybe swing over into Europe. So what we have is, in a time period of which we're talking about, and if we say that the Roman civilization ended at 400, and if we say Christianity or Christendom ended in 1600, we have a 400-year gap in which there's no explanation on why the church didn't unify everything. Because, as we know, Catholicism was made the state religion of the Roman Empire around 387. Now, from 387 to 800, we have no unity whatsoever to speak of. And I think this is an interesting point, the unity which we talk about is presented to us from church historians. Okay, this is one of the major flaws I see in the whole thing. It appears to me, unless I'm very wrong, that essentially from the fall of the Roman Empire until, again, around the time of Luther, historians were essentially chroniclers who were abbots, monks. They were, we presume, trying to put the best or the worst of view on things, depending on their own particular point of view from the church. In other words, they were trying to show how bad morals were, or they were trying to show how good the church was. And this means that same thing right now, anybody who studies this history of Russia only through communist sources is an idiot.
Yeah.
Because he realizes that they're, and the same thing, anybody who studies the Tudor time period studies the Plantagenet time period only through the Tudor historians understands the same problem.
Right.
They're trying to put a bad view on the preceding dynasty.
Right.
And since we have nothing but church historians for roughly 1,000 years,
right.
Then we say, well, this is that the church unified things. This, I think, is a massive, massive defect which no historian can do. And I think one of the problems is there we have this huge gap which is completely unexplainable. We have from 800 to roughly 1500, we have at least some concept of the Holy Roman Empire, which one could definitely attribute to the Pope and say that the church formed that. But by the same token, we have the unification of Spain, the unification of England, the unification of France under nationwide kings, and it appears as if the church didn't seem to have anything directly to do with those things. As a matter of fact, of course, I'm sure you're aware that the French kings frequently fought against the popes, and we have examples like Philip the Fair actually capturing the popes, the Avignon papacy. If we call that Catholic, then we might as well call Martin Luther a saint, because it was as anti-Catholic behavior as possible. And I use just as an example of this, and I think what we're doing, and I think Dawson makes a terrible mistake, I'll make one last point and then just jump in, please, is the perfect example of Napoleon, who brought the Pope to his coronation as emperor to put the trappings of Catholicism on a French empire, then captured the Pope and dragged him around for a while, made him a formal prisoner because he wouldn't acquiesce in all of Napoleon's demands. Now, the point is, if Napoleon had just died at the coronation, we would say, oh, yes, really unifying the France and his whole empire by a Catholic facade. But his true sign of a suppression of many of the religious orders in the monasteries shows that he was extremely anti-Catholic. But on the surface, it looked as if he actually was unifying things on the surface of the church. And I think what we're making a mistake here is, and I think it's the one mistake that no historian can make and call himself an historian, is to confuse appearances with reality. And I think that's Dawson's major fault.
Well, I agree that up to about 800, there probably was not a sense of a common Christian civilization or a culture. There were a series of Christian, what Dawson would call Christian barbarian cultures. You know, various barbarian regions that had converted to Christianity. You know, you, as you say, it was a gradual process, the conversion of Europe and the various barbarian tribes and the peasant culture underlying the various barbarian aristocracies, really. But he calls them barbarian cultures because they were dominated by, barbarian type of warrior class. Now, when I first read Dawson, I had a similar objection that you did, but gradually I began to see that the truth of what he was saying. We can't, he would argue that you can't expect an 8th century warrior to think the way we do. You know, when he absorbed the Christian message, he came from a warrior background. Now, you can't expect him to shed his whole warrior psychology and outlook and think the way St. Paul did or St. Peter. You know, there was a fusion of the Christian ethos and the barbarian ethos. You know, and the best example are the Crusades. Now, to say that this is anti-Catholic, well, that's, in a sense, it's true. It's not the perfect expression of Catholicism. But by that standard, you know, you'd never get any culture to be a Christian at all, because our culture is a culture of converted, let's say, bourgeois classes. Now, the bourgeois ethos and the Christian ethos don't mix too well either, you know? But that doesn't mean that you can't call these cultures Christian in some real sociological sense. I mean, I think you have to take people the way they are, where they're at. And if you convert a warrior king, well, the kind of Catholicism that he's going to internalize is going to be some psychological synthesis between the Christian message that you've given him and his warrior upbringing, you know? And the warrior ethos it has a particular outlook on life, you know? The greatest thing in life is to die in battle. You know, bravery is the key element in the warrior ethos. And anyone who is not brave is looked upon as subhuman almost, in a sense. So when Christianity was transformed from the Hellenistic cities there of the Roman Empire and started to flow into barbarian Europe, you know, it mixed with the peasant ethos, okay, which is different from the warrior ethos. But it also mixed with these warriors, and it was inevitable, you know, that the fusion took a form that is a little alien to what we think, because I didn't grow up with a warrior ethos either. You know, and I found it strange when he said that these cultures were Christian. But I can understand from the historical, sociological point of view that you have to say that Christianity, on the ideal level, you know, the way Jesus taught it as a way of life, you know, is up there. But when it comes down and mixes with the world of history, it inevitably becomes contaminated by all kinds of impure mixtures. But that doesn't mean that we can't call these resultant fusions, you know, Christian culture in some real sense. I mean, then we would say that Well, what are you going to use as your description of these cultures? If you can't say that they're Christian in some sense, what are you going to say?
Okay.
That they're barbarian cultures, period?
Yeah.
Well, that would leave out the Christian element in their culture.
Let me jump in, okay? The first thing you said was something to the effect of you can't expect an 8th century man to think the way we do or expect a warrior to shed his ethos. I think this is the second failure with Dawson. Massive. And I think it was an interesting point because I believe you said that one of the experiences you found beneficial from reading Dawson was the bringing the concept of spiritual reality into history or something like that. I think when you were talking about his effect on you personally. And I think, of course, every Catholic has to acknowledge the reality of the spirit world as being the basis of the physical world. Otherwise, he's just got a facade of Christianity. I say that's exactly the point. I say that Christianity, truly accepted, does transform the person immediately. I use the example of Saul of Tarsus. Saul of Tarsus was the most anti-Catholic man of his day, and in an instant, he became a candidate for a Catholic bishop and later one of the apostles. Now, the point is, that's what Catholicism really does. It changes you totally. You are born again. You become a new person. You die to yourself, and you're born again. Therefore, I hold the exact opposite, that if a culture or a civilization, and I'm being a little sloppy because I don't think they're both the same words,
no,
but if a civilization were to become Christian,
yeah,
it would be transformed. And I think what you were saying is, by that standard, there's been no Christian civilization. That's exactly my point. I believe there has been none. And the reason I say there has been none is because, among other things, is I say that if you look at the history of Europe, as far as, say, warfare goes, trends go, cycles go, you see the same things occurring from when we have any kind of reliable records, say, roughly 500 BC, to the current days. And if you were to leave Christianity out completely, it doesn't matter. You see the Germans expanding and contracting. You see the people from the north invading the people from the south. You see the people from the south building up civilizations, which are then torn apart by the people of the north, who then intermarry and come and form a new civilization. And what I'm saying is the history of the pre-Roman civilization, the Roman civilization, the post-Roman civilization, the Renaissance, are all pretty much the same general trends. And the fact that at one time they carried a cross in front of them, another time they carried a silver eagle, and another time they carried maybe a symbol of Thor, doesn't make a difference. I'm saying these same cycles go over and over and over. And I think that's exactly the point. It hasn't made a difference. It hasn't made a difference in the behavior of the people. And I love to point this out as what I think is a perfect example of it. Not so long ago, I believe it was 2 years ago now, the ACT UP, the militant homosexual group, invaded St. Patrick's Cathedral during a mass, and everybody was properly outraged. Now, what they did was desecrate the Blessed Sacrament, which, of course, was horrible. But other than that, they didn't attack anybody physically. They just sort of yelled and shouted and were ultimately removed. Back in the Catholic ages, we find Catholic knights invading churches to kill priests, to steal the sacred, the ciboriums, the chalices, which then they carried off as loot. Now, the point is, in those days, we had militant Catholic Englishmen sacking honest-to-goodness, real Catholic churches in France. The French doing the exact same thing. If we define the militant homosexuals as anti-Catholic, then we find the church, quote-unquote, or the church people of the Middle Ages, house divided against itself. And what I'm saying is, again, Thomas of Becket being killed at the altar, other bishops being killed tried to protect the Jews from so-called crusaders who weren't interested in going to Jerusalem, just interested in killing Jews. Now, the point is, bishops lay down their lives. We have people like St. Bernard coming forth to denounce other monks who are trying to lead pogroms. And also, which I find a very telling problem, is the whole element of the Crusades, the civilization of Spain, when both the Moors and the Jews and the Christians were intermixed, and the civilization of Sicily, where the same thing occurred, we find that the Christian knight, the Christian gentleman, the Christian peasant was able to intermix in those societies with no problems. And according to the historians I've read, when the Muslims won or the Christians won, it didn't change the peasant's life too much. It's just who he paid. Now, and also, the Christian knights, even the Templars and the Hospitallers, were able to form temporary and sometimes pretty long permanent truces and diplomatic relationships with the Saracen kings and rulers in the Holy Land. Why? Because their culture was the same. And the point is, if a man can go, as you rightly said, if you study the area of the Near East without understanding Islam, you're stripping yourself of a very necessary tool. But if the Christian could slip into that Islamic culture very easily and then slip out again without losing his faith, if he could have a relationship with his sort of Islamic knight on the other side, if he could understand the rules of chivalry, which are pretty close, if they could set up truces, if they could set up the same rules of war, if they coexisted with a great cultural flowering of literature, art, mathematics, and war in Spain for 700 years, then what I'm saying is, culturally, it was indistinguishable from what apparently was the Christian culture. And if it's indistinguishable from what is the Christian culture, that means the Christian culture doesn't exist, because the Islamic culture certainly does. I give you the example also of Japan. When the Jesuits arrived in Japan, it seems as if they were going to convert the whole country in one generation without destroying the Japanese culture, which seems to have been predisposed for Catholicism. And the reason, the ultimate reason it was closed was because the guy was so afraid that the missionaries were going to be the forerunners of Spain and Portugal, and he threw everybody out, and that was the reason the church was suppressed in Japan. But it was interesting. It wouldn't have been suppressed if they only made a few converts. They made massive numbers of converts, many of whom remained faithful for centuries. Why? Because they didn't have to change the culture at all. There's a guy, an economist, called Ludwig von, I think, von Mises, and he said something very interesting once. He said, Islam and Judaism are dead cultures, because they are so restrictive in their nature that they come in as an invigorating force and then they suppress. Because Muhammad and the comments from the Jewish rabbis on Moses regulate every activity of human behavior. But Christianity, being so sparse in its teachings on the relationship between man and man in commercial matters and in law and everything else, allows any culture to flourish underneath it. Because it is concerned, ultimately, Christianity, between the relationship between God and man individually, and man individually. But there is no such thing as a Christian way of passing a law. There is no such thing as a Christian jury system. There is no such thing as a Christian corporation law. There's no such thing as Christian rights of commerce or water rights. There's no such things as all the things which create a culture. There's no such thing really as Christian art. We think there is because we're prejudiced, but there really isn't. But there's Islamic art. There's Judaic art, there's Persian art, with very restrictive systems. But we don't have one, and that's the point I'm making. The things that go into making a culture, commercial relationships, social relationships, marriage laws, we have that. But they're very restrictive in a very negative sense. They say what you can't do, but they don't say what you can. And again, the so-called liberation of women has taken place under Christianity. It'll never take place under Islam, without Islam breaking that rigid structure it has. And what I'm saying is if Christianity can be imposed on every culture without breaking the culture, and of course I think it can, because obviously God made it for everybody, then it really doesn't create a culture. It can't create a culture. And that's my basic premise on that.
Okay. Well, to answer your first point, Dawson would say, he would agree with you on St. Paul. You know that the Christian message is that anybody can be transformed by the power of God's grace. Yeah. You know, that's the message of the Incarnation. But he would say that the perfect flowering of Christian culture is in the lives of the saints. Okay. They are the perfect symbol of the transformation of human nature. But the problem is, when you look at the historical evidence, the saints are a minority. You know, the average person in the culture that's being converted is a potential saint. You know, we're all potential saints, but the degree of holiness to which their lives are transformed, you know, varies in tremendous degrees. So I think the difference between you and Dawson is that Dawson would allow a culture that has saints but that has many more compromising Christians, you know, to be called Christian. You would only call a culture Christian that, you know, had a majority of saints in it, whereas he would say, well, that's historically and sociologically impossible. You know, human nature being what it is, and evil being what it is, you're going to get various gradations of the integration of grace and sin, or not the integration, but the conflict between grace and sin in the life of various social classes within that culture. And to condemn that culture and say it's not Christian because, you know, two-thirds of them have not really attained the level of spirituality that the saint has in that culture, and to say that that's not Christian, he would argue that that's not a valid historical point of view. And he could probably point to Islam that you've been talking about. Islam also is a religion. It's based on the Old Testament, and, you know, he also heard stories from the New Testament and his own particular beliefs. It also hopes to transform, you know, the people who come under the teaching of the Quran to devote their lives to the belief in the one God, you know, and the ethical outlook there is also taken from Judaism and a bit of it from Christianity. But it also tries to transform the cultures it came into contact with to conform to the pattern of holiness that Muhammad had set down in the Quran. You know, so Darcy would say all the cultures that were touched by what he calls the world religions, you know, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, even the Confucian tradition in China, they all have this problem of dualism, you know, between the vision of Buddha and the actual social classes that accepted the Buddhist message and try and live the, you know, the Buddhist vision, but they inevitably come up short on, you know, on many levels. So he says, if you can talk about the dualism between, you know, the vision of the Buddha and the average cultures that accepted the Buddhist message and the vision of Muhammad and the various cultures that were converted to to Islam, you know, he says, well, you can do the same thing with Christianity. And so if you can talk about an Islamic culture and a Buddhist culture, as I pointed out last night, you have to understand that there are various classes that will accept the vision of the founder in various degrees. And even if, you know, they've only internalized it one-third, and another another group of persons have internalized it a little more than that. And then you've got the saints in the various cultures too, the Buddhist holy ones and the Islamic, you know, they've got their holy spiritual archetypes too. That it's still not correct to say that these cultures were not united by a common vision and a common faith, and it's not correct to say that they're not Christian or they're not Islamic, because a religion has to permeate a culture through the classes that it converts, and there's an inevitable resistance there, you know, and there's an inevitable failure, and there's the dark side of that cultural picture, like you brought out very well. But the historian has to look at the dark side, and he's got to look at the other side, you know. And in the last analysis, what makes a culture Christian or non-Christian or Islamic or some other thing is the spirit that informs that culture. And how do you discover the spirit that informs that culture? You study its spiritual expression. Now, if you study the literature, the art, the architecture, the literature and art and those are the two most common. But okay, you study their philosophy, their philosophers and their theologians. You know, you begin to see that there is some vision. You know, there is some spiritual vision in in art, in literature, in philosophy, in theology. To some extent, you know, there's some common spirit informing all those various expressions of the life of a culture. And if that spirit is a predominantly Christian one, no matter how, you know, it's deflected through various social forms, well, then he would say it is valid to call it a Christian culture. But he says a Christian culture is not a perfect culture. You know, it's a, as he said, the barbarian cultures were a culture of converted barbarians. And let's say 18th century or 17th century American culture was a culture of converted bourgeois townsmen, you know, who came from England, from the upper and lower bourgeois classes, and the same thing of 17th century Holland, you know, or you know, of 19th century England, the founders of the makers of the Industrial Revolution, most of them came from the Protestant nonconformist class. He would say that's a form of Christian culture. It's a Protestant form. But since they profess some form of the Christian faith, that however distorted or diluted a form it is, if they see that Christ is divine in some way, well, they've got some glimpse of the Christian message, you know?
Okay.
I think that's where he would differ from you.
Yeah, but see, I don't buy that. Okay?
I know that.
Okay, and the reason I don't is... again, I'll try to use an example of Islam because, number one, I think that's a little more common. And number two, we have a little more, I think the average person, and certainly I, have a little more sense of what that is.
Right.
Okay. There's a big difference between, you pointed out before, the difference between what should be and what is. Okay. I'm not dealing with that. I acknowledge, number one, that people fail. And I'm not saying that a Christian culture is necessarily one full of saints, but it's an interesting point because I also point out, just as a sidebar, that the fact that there have been saints in literally every land, under every culture, under every degree of suppression or freedom, means that Christianity survives, prospers in every place. Okay, and I think that's an interesting point from my side. But the second thing is, there's a big difference between I do and I should do. Mm-hmm. Because if you admit you should do something, then you're acknowledging a standard. And let me say that one of the things I hold that a culture has to have in order to exist is an ultimate value beyond which there is nothing else. This is the last. A Christian culture will have a Christian ultimate value. Whether it's loyalty to the Pope, veneration of the Blessed Sacrament, love of neighbor, I don't know, okay?
Right.
But it'll have something.
Right.
Now, the thing about Islam is, again, from the literature I've read, and again, the movies, which is an interesting point, is the Islamic guy might very well do things wrong. But he says, well, I know Mohammed says this, but sometimes it's not possible. I really should, but I shouldn't. I remember a movie called The Wind and the Lion, and I remember in it Sean Connery is playing a Muslim Barbary pirate. So the proper way to fight is with the sword. He says, sometimes that's not possible, so we use rifles. But you're Europeans, you use cannons. That's ridiculous. Notice, sometimes it's not possible, so we go to the next stage. The European doesn't say what's right or wrong. What I'm saying is the European Christian culture, I don't see, based on my readings and my study of history, I don't see an acknowledgement of this is the way I should be. Example, the warfare which took place, which the church is always trying to mitigate, ultimately with the truce of God and the peace of God and all those other things, that came down between Christian Knight and Christian Knight, and it certainly was an improvement.
Yeah.
But the Christian Knight never felt that it applied to the peasants. And he would ride over the peasant's property, and he would kill the peasant soldiers, even though he would ransom the knight, and then go home. And he never said, you know, I wish I could kick this bloodlust. I don't see any references for that. I don't see any references in the secular literature of the time of them saying, my God, if we could only really become men of peace, or if we could only extend the chivalry to everybody. No, they didn't accept the fellowship of the brotherhood of the other men. And the point I'm making is it wasn't a matter of compliance or non-compliance, because probably the Muslims behaved just as badly in war. But I get a sense of the Muslim going home and saying, I've done wrong. It's the old Greek concept of that blood sometimes makes you impure. And after you fight, even though you're defending your country, you have to become purified before you go into the mysteries. You have to wash the blood off. I don't see that in the quote-unquote Christian cultures.
I don't see an acknowledgement of the Christian value of charity. I don't see an acknowledgement of the Christian concept of a pope. Again, even there, the constant warfare between the popes and the emperors was, we can overthrow you. You're not a real pope anymore. Hey, to heck with you. It doesn't even seem to be an acknowledgement that somehow he has this ultimate spiritual authority. And that's the point I'm getting. It's not a matter of internalized versus non-internalized. It's not a matter of whether you really act the way you're supposed to act. It's whether you acknowledge there is some way you're supposed to act. Is there a code of ethics or a code of morality? And what I'm saying is, just like today, we see very little of that. Sometimes you see lip service, but even lip service I'd be happy for if it were universal. But I don't see it universal. Again, even when the Christian states want war against one another, I could be wrong, but even in the little, again, original documents I've read, or the translations of them, I don't see where people saying, you know, God help us that we have to keep going to war this way, and it's terrible. I see these insults from one king to another saying, then come to get my rights. And nobody says, well, I'm turning the other cheek. Or nobody even says, I've turned the other cheek 15 times, and now I have to defend my homeland. No, it's come here, and we'll knock the crown off your head, or come there, and we're brave, and we have lots of graves for you to go into. In other words, it isn't this lust. It isn't the man who struggles with his sin and constantly goes to confession, repents, and reforms, and fails again. It's a man who doesn't seem to seek an ultimate value. I give one example, which I think a perfect example of this. All cultures, from what I can see, that have valued political power have used assassination as a means of getting to the top. The Ottomans made it formal. What they did was, as you may or not know, and I don't mean to insult you that way, but when the man became the sultan, he would send word that all of his brothers were to be strangled. Mm-hmm. Therefore, there would be no civil wars. Mm-hmm. Now, when this was first instituted, they went to the Muslim holy men and said, are we allowed to do this by the Quran? And they searched through and found some exaggerated things which they twisted to justify murder. And that's all it is. But notice, they tried to justify murder in their religious system. In the Christian system, when I see assassinations go on, and it seems like it's filled with them, it was usually for a political reason, and I don't see this great sense of, like, Macbeth, you know, now seeking repentance. I think that's a perfect example. Macbeth never goes to a priest and asks for forgiveness for his sin. Instead, what he does is just suffer miserably for it. He suffers psychologically. He suffers spiritually. But he doesn't seek the forgiveness of confession, which a Christian culture should have. Macbeth is a very interesting example. Here is a perfectly Christian culture in which God is never mentioned once in a while, nor forgiveness of sins. Jump in. Thank you.
Okay. To deal with what you're saying here, let's take this period where Christianity is in contact with the warrior culture. Okay, what I've described there. Now, we have archaeologists. Now Dawson, read as much of the archaeological evidence he could, because he really loved archaeology. He was fascinated by the fact that the archaeologists could dig up a lost culture for generations and give you some picture of what that culture was like. And now if you study, say, one of those barbarian cultures, say around 800 AD, you study some of the literature that's been preserved, you study its art, you study whatever you've dug up and you can form some picture of, you're going to find that the religious outlook and the ethical outlook of that culture is what they call a pagan outlook. It's a worship of many gods, and these gods to these people were the forces of in the universe stronger than they were, like the wind and the sun and the whatever. They were supernatural in the sense that they were greater and stronger than man, and all human life depended on these forces. So you Dawson would say, you study the literature of these peasant culture, peasant groups and these warrior peoples, and then you, side by side with that, you study, you have the peace society and the warrior society. You have the monks, and you have the warriors. Now, you're going to see a gradual fusion, you know, of Christianity and the warrior ethos. And probably the best example is St. Louis at its highest level. Here's a warrior king, you know, who becomes a saint. But for every St. Louis, there were 500, you know, kings who were not saints, you know. And for every St. Bernard, you know, you probably had monks that compromised their vocation to some extent. But Dawson would say, if you study these warrior cultures and their expression through art and literature and whatever you've dug up, whatever you've preserved, and then you study the, let's say, in 800 AD, and then you study the same barbarian Europe, in a sense, you know, 1200 BC, it's still a culture of converted barbarians, you know. You're going to see that the Christian spirit has penetrated the art and the literature. And, well, now, theology and philosophy were not part of the barbarian cultures, you know. But you're going to find the flowering in a city type of civilization, eventually, especially around the Mediterranean, but even around the great rivers and the trading routes, you're going to see a change, you know, from the pure barbarian culture of 800 AD. If you study that literature alone, and then you compare the literature of the European converted, quote, classes at 1200 or 1300, you're going to see a change in the barbarian ethos. You know, you're going to see, I mean, you don't have a million St. Louis, but you do see the gradual penetration of the Christian and the warrior ethos there. And in Italy, you're going to see a penetration of Christianity and the bourgeois ethos, because the Italian, you know, Mediterranean communities were the great trading cities, you know, and here the profit motive and the type of life was quite different, say, from 12th century, let's say, Paris and 12th century Genoa, you know. So here you've got an urban maritime type of culture where, you know, the trading classes and the merchant class has a dominant position. You know, the doges of Venice were not warriors in the sense that, let's say, St. Louis was. So here you have the if you study the art, you know, of 13th century Italy, you're going to see a Christian bourgeois culture in some sense, you know, a fusion of Christianity and the merchant ethos. You know, I mean, St. Francis' father is a very good example, you know, of a man who made a fortune trading silk. And then you have, now, his father was not a saint, but Francis became a saint, you know, and he revolted against that type of merchant ethos. But still, you can't study the literature and art and philosophy and theology of these 13th century, let's say, Italian city-states and Italian culture without seeing a definite Christian imprint on that culture. So,
hold it 1 second, please.
So, I would say the clearest evidence that you could have is to compare a culture that was untouched to some extent, not touched by Christianity in Europe, and a culture that has been touched by Christianity, say for 300 or 400 years, and there you do see the difference. I mean, if you read the literature, just take the literary evidence and the artistic evidence. You know, the culture of the Celts, for example, or the Celts, whatever you want, I don't know the pronunciation. You know, before they were Christianized, they dug up a lot of stuff on the Celts. Now, you study their religion and their art, and you'll see a pure barbarian culture. They were a warrior aristocracy, the Celts. Now, you study that, and then you study, you know, the Celts, the people who were the Celtic population 500 years later, you're going to see a big difference. And this is what Dawson was saying. He would say, if you look at the evidence, whatever evidence we have dug up, you know, in the various branches, And you study the barbarian, for example, culture by itself, and then 500 years later, or 200 years later, you're going to see that the Christian spirit permeates that culture to some extent, you know, and therefore we can call it a Christian culture, or rather a Christian barbarian culture.
Okay, I think you just made my whole case, all right? One of the things I found that if you read basic history books, which are essentially for the novice, which is pretty much the type I read, okay, one of the things it says is something like this. Well, in the Hindu culture, the highest was the Brahmin, the second was the trader, the third was the merchant,
yeah,
and the fourth lowest class was the peasant, and
yeah,
below
the
that was the prostitute or something like this. The point is there's a social ranking. That's one of the signs of a culture. What's the highest thing? It seems like still in our culture, one of the screwy things about America is we both think lawyers are horrible and everybody wants their child to become one. Okay, yeah, really screwy, but that's neither here nor there. We think of used car salesmen and prostitutes as bad. We somehow think of politicians as both good and bad. Really one of the problems. But the point I'm trying to make is this, and I think you hit it dead on. In Venice, the trader, the businessman, the wealthy businessman, the sharp trader, was the top man. In the Celtic society, it was the scholar or the poet. In France, it seems to have been either the politician, the knight, or the troubadour. In other places, it was the thinker, or the scholar, or the philosopher, or the warrior. Now, the point I'm making is, by definition, these are all different cultures. And by definition, I agree perfectly, I hope I haven't gone in the opposite here, that Christianity has permeated and affected some of this. But that's exactly my point. We're not talking fact here, we're talking historical points of view, that many of the popular saints were adoptions of legends that existed beforehand. Okay, now that's not the point. I'm not saying St. Christopher didn't exist, but they pretty much grabbed them as prototypes and pre-types, so they made Thor into Michael the Archangel. That doesn't mean Michael didn't exist, but the point is, They sort of adopted what was there
That's
before.
The peasant religion.
Right.
Christianizing the peasant
exactly.
religion.
Exactly. Yeah. If you Christianize the peasant religion, that doesn't make it bad, and it doesn't mean it won't save your soul, but it means it didn't change it. What it did was adopt it to Christian forms. It put it in a Christian format. It put a Christian truth under a prefiguring of, say, natural law that was already in the heart of man. But that's exactly the point. That's not a Christian culture. That is the truth of Christianity, like the yeast and the bread, permeating the culture that pre-existed. And that culture continues to exist, although now it has Christian truth, grace, and sacraments in it.
Yes.
Again, that is why, so it seems from my experience, that the way people even built different churches and today, the way they worship in New Guinea, the way they sacrifice the Mass in New Guinea is quite different than the way we do it, and quite different than the way they do those rites in either the Byzantine or the Maronite churches. The point is why? Because those are still cultures which are allowed to maintain much of their cultural practices, but now have Christian truth, grace, and sacrament within it. And that's exactly the point.
Dawson would agree with that.
But
that's
if that
the
doesn't
way to
change
go.
The culture, if it only induces truth, grace, and sacraments, it leaves the culture alone, and there is no such thing as a Christian culture.
Well,
and one more point. Okay?
Okay.
I think one of the things Dawson might be making a mistake on, again, one of the big mistakes any historian can make, is the post hoc, ergo propter hoc. He's saying, look at something in 800, look at something in 1200, it's changed. Right. Look at Rome in 400 BC, then look at Rome at the time of Christ. It's changed. But it wasn't Christianity that changed it, because Christianity wasn't around.
No.
Almost everything changes over 400 years.
Yeah.
Right. Now,
but what is... Okay.
There's the point. There's a big mistake here to assume that change is always because, you know, something occurs in 800 and something occurs in 1200. It doesn't mean that the event in 800 influenced the event in 1200.
No.
I think that's the problem the historian has to do.
No.
Yeah, right. It could be parallel structures.
No.
But my key point, I'd like you to comment on it if you could, is this concept of accepting the states and accepting of the literature and the changing of it. I would say that, again, the pre-Islamic Arabian literature is probably quite different from the post-Islamic. And the pre-Hindu Indian literature is quite different, and the pre-Buddhist literature.
Right.
But the Christian literature, I don't think, is that much different. I think, again, it's just an infusion of truth. If I could use a simple analogy, it's an inoculation which you get to prevent you from getting polio. Christianity is an inoculation in the culture of a body to prevent it from falling prey to sin, or to give it the resistance against sin so it can be saved, but it doesn't change the culture. In the same sense, when you received your polio injection, you did not change as a human being. All you are now is inoculated against a particular disease. Christian virtues, Christian grace, Christian sacraments enable us to resist particular sins so that we can be saved. But we can be saved as in a warrior culture, in a trading culture, in a scholarly culture, in a literary culture, in a farming culture, all of which continue to exist under Christianity, and that's exactly why I think Dawson's wrong. There is no such thing as a Christian culture, only Christian truths, which can...
Let's try and approach it this way. Every culture has certain institutions, okay, that even, you know, the most primitive level of culture has some institutions that that give it continuity and stability. Let's take an institution such as the family. Okay, when he was, let's go back to the barbarian Europe here, you know, or the culture of the Roman Empire. You know, when Christianity, okay, we'll go before barbarian Europe. We'll take the culture of the Hellenistic cities of the Roman Empire. Now, the family in the Roman Empire, as you know, accepted abortion, accepted infanticide. You know, all those things were going on and were not protested. Now, when a man became a convert to Christianity, he was told abortion is a serious evil. You know, infanticide is a serious evil. So there was, you know, and if the slavery, you know, a lot of people are hung up on slavery. Slavery to the ancient world was what machinery to the modern world is, you know. And there was no way you were going to change slavery. I mean, it would have caused a social revolution of such drastic proportions that the society would have fallen apart. So what St. Paul tells the slave master of Onesimus is that you cannot treat this slave of yours as a subhuman person. You know, he's been a baptized Christian, he's got a human soul, enlivened by grace, therefore you have to treat him as a person. You know, a fellow Christian, even though he's a slave. So I would say that the institution of slavery, the institution of the family, even the institution of the state was to some extent changed when it converted to Christianity under Constantine, you know? So here you have basic institutions, slavery, the family, you know, even the state. Once Christianity becomes the dominant religious force, these institutions undergo a subtle change. And we can, you know, I said you look at the art and the literature, but I forgot to mention you have to, Dawson put a lot of emphasis on the institutions of a culture and the way religion slowly permeates these and affects a gradual change in these. And perhaps in that sense, it might make you understand how, in what sense he could say that culture became Christian, because not only did it find expression in art and literature and philosophy and theology, but it found expression in distinctive institutions that were different before Christianity came in contact with them. And for example, the Constantinian state became more like the ancient god state, you know, of the ancient pharaohs, because it was brought into relationship with that type of Middle Eastern centralization of power that occurred under, you know, the Egyptian pharaohs, and after that in Roman Hellenistic Egypt. But even that type of centralization of power in the monarch, there was still a kind of a Christian tone to that, which made it different from, say, the type of God-centered state that it was in pre-Christian times. You know, even there you see a subtle transformation. So, you ultimately, you know, the historian has to go by the evidence, just as much as a scientist, you know, has to say, well, here's the empirical evidence, and from this we have to work our, you know, our scientific experiment. You know, we have to go with this, with this, and with this. Well, Dawson would say, when you're studying a culture, you got to study this, 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 and this, and try and form a picture in your mind, use your historical imagination to try and get a unified picture of this culture in this particular place in this particular time. And when he did that, he genuinely did see a Christian spirit informing that culture, and he called it a Christian culture. Now, other people called it Christendom or Christianity or, you know, what was the other word they used? Anyway, the point was that there was this change. Without Christianity, the Europe we know today would never have existed, because of the change that the church had over this long period of time. Maybe that institutional thing that I was trying to tell you. Well, look at the fundamental teaching of Jesus and our Lord and Saint Paul, you know, on the man and wife and marriage. Now, that was a revolutionary thing. The woman was treated in the marriage ceremony. I mean, she is on the exact same spiritual level as the man. You know, you know when Saint Paul, the famous letter in the Ephesians there on marriage, where he says, you know, you have to treat your wives a certain way, and your wife, you have to, you know, submit to your husband in a certain way, and that both of you have to answer to our Lord, you know, on this point. I mean, this was a revolutionary point of view, you know, in the Roman Empire. Now, it didn't transform things immediately, but over a few hundred years, a form of marriage took place that was quite different from the main type of marriage that, say, had occurred in Rome or in Greece, you know, for 500 years or 1,000 years. The revolutionary teaching there of both the husband and wife as being spiritually valuable in God's sight, you know, inevitably had to work some kind of a change in the outlook on marriage and family and children, and you know what I mean?
A yes and no. But see, once again, it used an interesting expression. You said the word "that culture." Once again, if one were to say the Christian culture, and one were to write a book about it, as if worse, you know, the old classic thing that people have used, "I'm from Mars, I'm coming here, I'm going to send a letter home." Who's the top man in the Christian culture? Well, was Venice Christian? Yes. Was it the Doge? Yes. Was he a merchant prince? Yes. Who was it in France? Perhaps the king. Well, wait a minute. Then it's not the same culture because a different man's on top. Once again, in the Mohammedan culture, it's Mohammed, his prophet, then his successors, then splitting, you know, at least his relatives have some kind of preference, and then, of course, these people and the caliphs and all that stuff. And again, they may argue over who the identification of these people are, but there is an acknowledgement somewhere. The African cultures, even the kings who have only ceremonial functions, he still has the highest status, etiquette-wise. We don't have that in a Christian culture.
Okay, well...
And therefore, it's not a culture.
No.
Can't call it that culture if the Doge is top in one part of it, the king is part in another, and the philosopher wandering troubadour is in another.
Okay.
It's not the same culture.
Well,
who gets
okay, Dawson. Okay, Dawson would say politically that's correct. You know, you've got all kinds of centers of political power.
Culturally.
Okay, no. Okay. Well, a culture has...
Ireland was a Christian culture and it had no political unity for 1,000 years.
Okay, well, you have the political form of a culture, you know. Let's say a culture... Okay, he says a civilization is the union of various regions under a common vision.
Oh, I thought that was very good and I'll steal
it.
I thought that was a good point. Excellent point.
Now,
and I agree.
Now, in these various regions, you're going to get various social types and various types of authority, you know? But he would say in 12th century Europe...
What's the common vision of Christendom? I don't see any. I don't see how you could...
Well, the unifying forces, he would say, from about the time of St. Boniface in the 8th century...
Okay.
...to the crisis in the 14th century.
Okay.
Let's take the 8th to the
14th.
Good enough. Okay. He would say, what was the common bond of unity there in the institutional sense? Okay. It was the union of the papacy with monasticism. Those two institutions kept the various regions of Europe together in some kind of unity. That's his thesis.
Right. But you see, as soon as you start saying some kind of unity, what you're now saying is you're disregarding everything that wasn't unified and regarding everything that was. It's simply like the American Civil War, okay? If you're from the South, you look at the American Civil War as a fight of states' rights. We were fighting for freedom. If you're from the North, you look at it as a war to end slavery. We were fighting for freedom. Both sides were fighting for freedom, but of course both sides also were fighting for oppression. The white Southerner was fighting for the right to suppress the black man, and the white Northerner was fighting for the right to tell the white Southerner exactly how he should vote and exactly what political system he has to live under. Both sides were completely wrong, and both sides were completely justified. And you can say, well, there was some degree of unity on this and some degree of unity on that. That's right. As soon as we throw in the word some degree, we've thrown out absolutely everything.
Okay.
In my opinion. Because a culture has to have, by definition, an ultimate value. Again, the Islamic culture is the revelation of God to Muhammad and the understanding of those revelations. Now, I'm not saying they follow it any more than we follow anything. Okay? But again, even if you want to argue in the political system in America, one could make a case, at least temporarily, that a Supreme Court decision is the ultimate decision beyond which there is no appeal. So you could argue this even in American culture. You could also argue that there's a standard of beauty in America based on Christie Brinkley or somebody else. Okay? Beyond this, there is nobody prettier. The prettiest woman in the United States. The fastest car. The most beautiful house. Again, doesn't mean to say there aren't some fanatics somewhere who disagree. But at least you could define these things. Okay? What I'm saying is, if we can't define it, if we say that, yes, it was the papacy and the monasticism, which was a marvelous unifying force, agree totally. But a unifying force is quite different from actually creating a culture. Unifying force in America was the bayonets of the Union Army, which raped, burnt down the Southern power structure, destroyed their plantations, and killed their sons for a political force. Now, you could say, well, it was the triumph of the Union. No, it was the Stalin of America, Abraham Lincoln, enforcing his particular view of what he thought the political environment was by the deaths of his fellow citizens. It sounds to me like an Old Testament, you know, king just slaughtering everybody who disagrees with them. But you could say it was a unifying force. No, it was the political power of the bayonet. And what I'm saying is, this was a social power, of course. It was a cultural power, of course. I'm simply saying that it didn't achieve what it should have achieved. What it brought was a supernatural element into a natural world.
Okay. Well, to take the Civil War, like you said.
Yes.
Okay. You know, and take the South in 1890. Now, it's obviously different from the South in 1840.
Sure.
But no historic, I don't think anybody with a little historical background would say that the South in 1890 forms part of a Siberian culture. No, it obviously is still part of an American culture. You know, it's not the same. It's sociologically, it's been transformed to a great extent, not totally, but it's still an agrarian type of society, you know, to some extent, much more than in the North. But it's still, if you read the literature of the South, you know, in 1840, and you read the literature of the South in 1890, you're still going to see an American tone in that literature.
Sure.
You know, so Dawson would say, you know, Europe was never centralized politically under one absolute ruler. Never, no. So you can't say it was a Christian unified culture in a political sense.
Agreed.
No,
not
no.
Even, never said that.
No, he never.
And I never said he said it.
No, no. He said institutionally, you did have the papacy and monasticism, which had a power of leadership from about 800 to 1200, you know, and this did give, he uses the word centripetal and centrifugal forces in the culture. And he says the centripetal forces of the papacy and monasticism were strong enough to overcome the centrifugal forces to a significant degree. And then after, I think, the 13th century, of course, the papacy faces a crisis, and monasticism undergoes a process of corruption, and these two forces disintegrate. But he would say, still, even at the peak of their power, let's take the 12th century, if you make it a point to study the literature and art and philosophy and theology of the various regions in Europe, in Spain, in England, in France, in Germany, in Italy, if you study all these cultural manifestations of Christendom, because they considered themselves Christendom, not Europeans, I think, in the 12th century, you will see that each region is different in the way it expresses its Christian outlook, but it is, they all have a definitely Christian outlook. Although, you know, the 13th century Italy is going to have a different sociological picture than 13th century England, you know. In England, you're going to have the feudal element much more powerful than you will in Italy.
Let me jump in.
You know? So he would say that you could still talk about Christendom and a Christian spirit in that culture, even though there are various forces working against any kind of political unity.
What you've done, I believe, is subtly begged the question. What you did was you said that in the culture, the forces of unity were the monastic
the
union
papacy,
with Pope.
Yeah.
I said, which culture? The culture that this was trying to unify. Well, which culture is that?
Europe.
Well, no, well, that's the point of making. Every time I've asked for a definition of the culture, I get it's the one that the papacy and the monasticism were trying to bring together. The point is, what I think you're doing, subtly, and I think Dawson did it also, is you're defining something. Okay, let's assume something.
Okay, let's
call it a culture, and then let's say what worked on it. And now, how have we defined the culture? It was the thing that this thing was
working
on.
Okay, let me be more precise. Let me be more precise. What we look upon today as Europe.
Yeah.
Okay. The different regions that we name, label Europe
right.
today. In those days, were looked upon as Christendom. Now, what I'm saying is that monasticism and the papacy, and then the friars too, you know, in the 13th century, the universities and the friars did for the towns, you know, what the monks did for the countryside. Now, Dawson would say that the various regions of what we now call Europe were, and even Eastern Europe, I mean, the universities and the monks and the friars penetrated to Poland, and they penetrated to Hungary. You know what I mean, eh?
Sure.
Okay, so all that those regions and what we now call Europe that had a share in this, he would call common Christian culture that that had its center of unity in the papacy and in the monasticism and the 13th century orders there of the Franciscans and the Dominicans and the universities, all of these regions, you could say, were parts of a common, he would call it a Christian civilization in the 12th century. Because to him, the difference between a civilization and a culture is that civilizations are a more complex type of society. They have towns, you know. They have universities. That what makes a civilization different from a culture. So he would say we can speak legitimately of a Christian civilization of the 12th century in this particular area of the world, which comprise these various regions that we have names, you know, that we have named because we live in the 20th century.
Right.
But
and
we think of the nation state.
Right. But if one argues, and I think that's what you're doing, correct me if I'm wrong, that the ultimate value, the ultimate unifying force was the papacy in this.
Yeah.
And if we look at the history of that,
Yes.
What we find is an awful lot of anti-popes, an awful lot of popes dying outside of Rome in exile.
Oh, yeah.
An awful lot of that time, at least 100 years right before the millennium, in which the papacy was thought of as absolute garbage. Okay?
Oh, the ninth century is the nadir, the papacy.
Okay, so what we're talking about is a unifying force which it seems a significant period of the time, the people who are supposed to be unified of it were rejecting it. We have Hildebrand himself dying in exile while an anti-pope was on the throne. We have the Crusaders themselves marching through Rome. They can't go to St. Peter because Urban's not there. He's over at the anti-pope's in charge of St. Peter's right now. The point I'm trying to make is that the unifying factor is such that you can spend of roughly 400 years, roughly 370 of them rebelling against it, ignoring it, and a lot of churchmen writing documents that the council is superior to the papacy, that you don't have to pay attention to it, constantly evade. You have the great schism between the Western and the Eastern churches. And what I'm saying is, that can't be a unifying force if it's only theoretical and didn't cause the average person or even the political elites of the time to acknowledge that not that they are paying attention to the Pope, but that they should. Occasionally you have an Innocent III who is able to enforce things because of the force of his personality or spiritual authority. Doesn't really matter which. But the point is, most of the times, it seems to me, both the secular and religious authorities of the times were completely thumbing their noses at the popes, getting away with it, and saying, I don't have to listen to him. We had apparently as much heresy then as now. I always found this an interesting point, and I think everybody seems to ignore it. But if you take one of these simple books like A Saint for Every Day of the Year or something like that, and they have these, you know, four-paragraph summations of saints, it's very interesting how many saints from the year 800 to the year 1200 or beyond never left Italy, never left France, never left Germany, but spent their entire lives in missionary activities.
Mm-hmm.
St. Anthony of Padua was called the Hammer of Heretics, mm-hmm. and after he entered Italy, he never really left that region. What heretics was he hammering? He was hammering heretics within walking distance of Padua. Why? Because in those days, Italians weren't paying any attention to the church. They were and the Albigensian heresy, which almost destroyed Christendom, all of the other heresies that went around, so that even the radical Franciscans had to be burned by popes.
Mm-hmm.
The point I'm making is I don't see any unifying factor there at all. Instead, what I see is this thin veneer, which we historians or historians like to see unifying factors. Instead, what they do is they superimpose that on there. And I see no unifying culture of either. And again, from what I can read, it seems as if the monastic life was attacked frequently. And let me just compare that as an example to the Southeast Asian concept of Buddhism, where, if I remember correctly and what I've read correctly, and especially in Tibet, it is considered proper for each male to, at one point of his life, become a monk and spend some time in a monastery. And then monks are honored forever. Even the concept of begging. There it is considered quite honorable for monks to sit at the side of the road and beg. Begging is considered honorable and proper. In Christian culture, we can never make up our mind whether the beggar is another Christ or a bum who won't work. And if we can't make up our minds, it's because we don't have a cultural value. And let me advance an alternative here, which I don't expect you to think about now, but roll it over in your mind. That time from 800 to 1200, Europe was under siege. From the Norsemen, from the Magyars, from the Avars, and from the Mongols maybe coming into, and the Tartars, and of course the Saracens. If you look at it, the area we're talking about was the only part of Europe that was perpetually free, although they didn't know how long it was going to be free, and they didn't know when the next major invasion was coming, but at least these people were free. Maybe it was a siege mentality and a bunker mentality that made these people actually unified. Again, the literature at times, save us, O Lord, from the fury of the Norsemen, could have engendered in them a sense of, we're the last vestige of civilization. The same thing that unified England during World War II. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that they loved Winston Churchill, it was that they were so afraid of Hitler. Mm-hmm. The same thing that unified them when Napoleon was across the channel.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing that unified Spain when Napoleon invaded and deposed the king.
Mm-hmm.
Bunker mentalities give a sense of unity when there isn't a sense of unity. And when we look back, we say, well, what was characteristic of that time? Well, again, the churchmen were writing history. It's been traditional to look at it as the Catholic Age. So we say, well, they must have been unified by the Catholic Age, when actually they were unified by the fear of death tomorrow, of somebody sweeping in and killing our villages and wiping out our knights and besieging our castle, and we've got a very short life expectancy here. So let us instead join together, put aside our national petty disunities, and even if we don't put them aside, we should. The constant calling of the Crusades was, let's survive, these guys are at the gates, the barbarians are at the gates, and every now and then they say we would, sure, but the whole crusading spirit died off as the threat to Europe somewhat died off. And only when it surged back up under the Ottomans did we get the crusading spirit coming up again, but then it was disrupted by the Protestant revolt. And the point I'm just trying to make is, it seems to me that there might have been a unity there, a real one, but it might have been a siege mentality. Okay, and I still come up with the concept. See, I like the way you said it. I wrote down what he would call a common Catholic culture. I call it a non-common Catholic culture. Okay, you talked before about the concept of the scientist. I thought it was beautiful. But you see, to the average person, he thinks that water causes rust because he takes a piece of metal, puts it in water, and it rusts. It's the oxygen that causes rust.
Yeah.
Now, oxygen, of course, is an element of water.
Yeah.
But water itself is where oxygen loses its properties. Water actually has to break down to oxidize the metal. The scientist knows this, but the common sense says, no, it's water.
Okay.
And there's the point. You can come to the wrong conclusion on an experiment until, and there's the point about history. You look at the evidence, but unlike the historian, unlike the scientist, you can't go back and do the controlled scientific experiment.
No.
And I believe that one of the problems with Dawson, to me, is he approaches this literally as a Catholic. And then what he does is enforce his Catholic mentality on a reality which he wants to see. In other words, he doesn't approach it impartially. And I think a Catholic historian has to drop being a Catholic to be an historian. So, because it's a purely scholarly inquiry. Unless, of course, he wants to see the hand of God in there. But even then, that's a purely scholarly inquiry because God is not divorced. I think that's the problem with Dawson. That's my major objection to him. He's seeing things too much from a Catholic point of view so that he's enforcing his view of Catholicism on the reality that was there.
Okay. That's the second point.
Sorry.
The other point, you see, I discovered among the Dawson papers, and it's in this book, Inquiries into Religion and Culture, in the 20s, he made an intensive study of these other cultures, you know, world
Sorry,
cultures.
Oh,
okay.
Go ahead.
So you have to realize that in the 20s, he studied, as I said, all these cultures that he wrote about in The Age of the Gods, starting from the first prehistoric cultures up to about 1200 B.C. And then he made a study of these, what he called these world cultures, inspired by the world religions, you know, the culture of India, the civilization. He called it civilization because these world religions unified certain regions. And he studied China, India, and later he devoted more time to the study of Islam. And he's got about three chapters on Islam in the making of Europe. Now, he would say, you know, if you go microscopically onto Europe in the 12th century, you're going to see a lot with a microscope. You're going to see a lot of forces, you know, moving against one another, and it looks like a chaos, you know, it looks like no unity. But he says if you look at it telescopically, you know, from a further angle, and you compare 12th century Europe with 12th century China and 12th century India and 12th century Middle East, you'll see that the spirit informing Europe, what we call Europe, let's call it Christendom, at that time is obviously got a Christian element to it that the other world cultures don't have, you know. And in that sense, he says, you can talk about Christian Europe, because the dominant, amid all the different elements competing for this, that, and the other, the dominant thing that will strike an historian who compares, let's say, Europe with China and India and Islam, is that there's some definite Christian element in this group of regions, you know, that is informing that culture. And if you pick up, let's say, Piers Plowman, you know, a book, or Dante's La Divina Commedia, and you compare that with a comparable piece of literature in, you know, in 12th century China or India and Islam, you're going to see a definite Christian spirit informing that book. And you compare the art of 12th century Europe with the art of 12th century, let's say, Persia or 12th century China, I mean, it's going to hit you right away that this, you know, this is a Christian region. Because, and, you know, if you compare the institutions, you start studying the institutions in 12th century Christendom, and you compare them with these other world civilizations, you're going to find that there's a Christian element too there that's quite different from the Buddhist element in Southeast Asia. So, I suppose it's possible, you know, when you're really up close to some things that you only see the centrifugal elements and you don't see the unity. But when you start comparing world cultures, then you do see the unity. You know what I'm saying?
I understand what you're saying, but I still don't agree with it. I'll tell you why. Okay, two things. Well, three, actually. One is a flowering of a culture, shall we say, to use it. I'll just use the word. I don't want to use it, but I don't want to have to...
Well, Dawson uses it.
I know, but I'm saying it's not true. But
okay,
flowering,
whatever.
Take for a moment that there is a culture. I'm not saying it's true, but just so I don't argue the point.
A civilization.
Civilization's different. But if it flowers in the 1200s and then essentially fades away, what is to say it wasn't an aberration? Indian history has Akbar and Akosha, who one of whom tried to establish Hinduism, one of whom essentially was the guy who sent the Buddhist missionaries throughout Southeast Asia. Both of those times, there were aberrations. The Indians look back on them, and historians say they were wonderful times, but they were two men separated by, I think, 900 years or roughly,
even
more than that.
Oh, yeah.
And they were aberrations. They were interesting aberrations, but they were aberrations. Now, you can't say the Indian culture was actually a reflection of Akbar or Akasha.
No.
But what we can say is, my gosh, weren't these interesting guys? Could it not be just as reasonable from an historical point of view that in 12th century a whole bunch of guys just happened to be born sort of like Periclean Greece or the founding fathers in this country who got together and formed a certain aberration, historical aberration, which people then look back on and think somehow that this is the way it always was, always the way it should be, and it just happened to be the best time. I argue that this is instead, just as likely, from an historical or any other point of view, an island sticking out, you know, the top of which sticks out on the ocean and the rest of the time is ocean. Now, we don't say this is all a lot of land just covered with a little water. We say this is a lot of water broken by just a little bit of land. And you can actually say it either way, but it's far more reasonable because you need a boat to sail on this, that this is not land that you can just wade over because the water's too deep. The rest of the time, we don't see a flowering of the so-called Christian civilization or culture. We see... Again,
we do.
But that's why you picked the 1200s, I think.
Well, that was just an example.
Oh, okay, fine. I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. Then I'll drop that. But the point is this: you compare Fierce Plowman and the Divine Comedy. I say, look at the Arthurian legends and the Song of Roland and Nibelung.
Yeah.
There's no Christian. There are Christian hints in there, but not enough. Again, even the Grail.
The Song of Roland, there is.
Again. A little bit, but the vast majority of it is instead a warrior king fighting and
but who does he die for?
He dies literally
for Christendom.
What he dies for is not to betray his oath to Roland, and of course the point is he dies because of the most uncommon and uncharacteristic Christian vice of pride, because he refuses to blow his horn until he's dead to call for help, and instead he has the men under him die.
It's for la douce of France.
Fine.
Yeah.
But the point is, it also could have been the same exact things when they were pagan Franks. There's no Christian element in there that is different, I argue.
There is.
Now, okay, fine. But again, even if there is a Christian element, that does not make it a Christian civilization. It does not make it a Christian culture. It does not make it a Christian value system. Okay? It is like literally us saying grace before meals. That's the only thing that's different about us eating. While a Hindu can only eat with his right hand and not with his left. Okay? That's a culture. The Muslim who cannot eat a pig, that's a culture. When we don't eat meat on Friday, that's sort of 1/7 of a culture in a sense. But the point is, outside of us saying grace before meals, there was no different than the way we ate. Asian cultures, the women never eat with the men. They eat separately. That's a culture. We don't have that. We have situations where you can eat with the men or not eat with the men, children eat with the parents, not eat with the parents, and still be Christian. And that's my argument. Also, by the same token, I think you're perfectly correct. If you look at 1200, to use your example, 1200 Europe compared to 1200 Persia, China, Southeast Asia, Islam, different. Right. But 400 B.C. Europe was different from 400 B.C. China.
Oh, yes.
Now, what I'm saying is, if you look at the various dynasties of Egypt, you look at the various dynasties of Asia, and up until the Islamic invasion, you look at the various dynasties of Persia, you see a common culture going all the way through.
Yeah.
You see a love of certain things, an emphasis on certain things.
Oh, yeah.
The whole thing about China, of course, the barbarians come in and become China.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
But that doesn't happen with Europe. What I'm saying with Europe is they don't become Christianized, because Christianity, and I guess this is my key point that I'll make it sort of summation, is that Christianity is ultimately so individualistic, because it's the relationship between man and God and my relationship between me and you, which has to be in the heart, that it can be expressed in outward ways by me feeding you and clothing you and talking to you, but those are no different from the Muslim feeding someone else or the Muslim talking about Allah, except that we have truth and they do not. It is the supernatural element which separates the Christian from the non-Christian. It's the sacraments, it is the grace, it is the faith, it is God working within us. And those things can't be observed by the historian. And why don't you make a summary statement, because you got to leave and I don't want to go to the table.
Okay,
make it about 2 minutes, though. I'm running out of time.
Oh, okay, okay. What was the last thing you said there?
That it's the supernatural element which can't be seen, because it's the heart of man that changes and not the body.
Okay, okay.
So therefore, the historian cannot see a Christian culture because it won't have the same characteristics that an Islamic culture would, where it does change the body. I think it's interesting. We're circumcised in the heart and in the soul. They were circumcised in the body. I think, and their monks, you know, and wore the saffron robes. So I did too. But certainly when you became a monk in the Buddhist culture, it was a lot more different than
ours. What did you say before that? Because that gave me the clue to what I was.
That the element doesn't make a culture it. If it's still, that the differences in 400 BC Europe would be different from 400 BC China? No?
No.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry, I threw you.
Yeah, I did have an answer and then I lost it.
Ah, well, then God took it away from you because he didn't want you to say something.
No,
wrong.
It was something you were saying about religion.
Okay.
Well, you see, you're right.